Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. Get ready for a great hour together, news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Samantha Ellis, author of the new memoir on Iraqi Jews, Always Carry Salt. And we'll have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene.
You've been everywhere. What is the least Jewish place you've ever been?
That's a very good question.
Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Well, we are well and truly into 2026 now, and we're off to quite a peculiar, even wild start. Apparently, the fouled-up government of Venezuela, a country I suspect most Americans could not possibly locate on a map, presents the greatest danger to American interests in the whole world. And so our executive branch and military kidnapped their authoritarian president and his wife, and are putting him, at least, on trial in New York for something called narco-terrorism, which is a crime that the president of Honduras was convicted of in U.S. courts, and the same U.S. president who was in charge of the Venezuelan kidnapping of Maduro for narco-terrorism just pardoned the guy in Honduras. All of this is, well, a little hard to fathom. And then, for some even more unfathomable reason, our U.S. president and his team are ratcheting up diplomatic and perhaps military pressure on Greenland. Greenland? And claiming the U.S. should, well, conquer it, wresting it away from its current status as an autonomous territory of our close ally Denmark, which it has been part of for 300 years. If you are as puzzled by these sudden developments as most people are, and you aren't a big-time conspiracy theorist, which I certainly hope you are not, and that you also don't believe this is all some effort to distract people from Jeffrey Epstein files or something, then this looks like foreign policy by pure impulse, and mostly random impulse at that. Or maybe it's just government by distraction. Or maybe both of these wild, weird, and somewhat crazy international moves are a huge grab for natural resources, since Venezuela has tremendous oil reserves, which we are apparently taking away from them right now, while Greenland has large deposits of rare earth minerals and lithium and other valuable metals used in high-tech manufacturing. And since global warming is melting the ice cap that used to cover most of the giant, sparsely inhabited island, Greenland's mineral and metal wealth will be exposed to exploitation, and, well, who better to grab all of that than the U.S.? It does appear we are actually experiencing the rebirth of 19th century imperialism, and maybe the President of the United States wants new coaling stations in the North Atlantic, places for our whalers to hunt sperm whales for their oil. Actually, when you throw in all the crazy tariffs the U.S. government has suddenly implemented, plus all the anti-immigrant violence it is fomenting, we could well be reliving the 1890s all over again. I'm a little unclear that the people who voted to make America great again wanted to go back to the William McKinley administration days, but it appears that's what we've got going on now. Now, don't get me wrong. By all accounts, Venezuela's Maduro was a corrupt, incompetent, vicious president, cruel, who lost re-election badly, then refused to concede defeat and stayed in power. He pardoned all of his corrupt friends and allies, imprisoned all of his opponents, or drove them into exile. Huh. Cannot imagine that happening in America, now can you? Maduro also drove the small but historic Jewish community of Venezuela mostly out of the country and has aligned his government, like his predecessor Hugo Chavez did, with Iran and Russia and North Korea and China and, of course, with Palestinian terrorists. He's a bad guy, an illegitimate authoritarian dictator, an anti-Semite, and many other terrible things. Still, when's the last time we, that is America, kidnapped the head of another country? I didn't remember this offhand, but apparently back in 1989, we attacked Panama, grabbed their president Noriega, and sent him to prison for a long time. Let's see, that was 36 years ago, and the Panama Canal definitely has strategic importance to the U.S. But Venezuela? I don't recall it playing a significant role in our foreign policy calculations since the days of the Pirates of the Caribbean, which was before the U.S. even existed. Maybe Johnny Depp is somehow involved, too. If you find this all a little, well, bizarre, you are not alone. The entire world, with the apparent exception of Vladimir Putin and Russia, seems to view our most recent foreign policy initiatives as deranged. It's hard to see how the U.S. benefits from this, although it is kind of easy to see how oil companies might eventually benefit from it, except right now the world has a great surplus of oil, far more oil than it's actually burning. To be honest, I'm trying to figure out what this sudden wild activity in Venezuela and about Greenland means for our foreign policy positions on the Middle East, and especially for Israel. I mean, right now, the administration seems to be super pro-Israel and certainly pro-Netanyahu. But if we are genuinely going to do foreign policy by the seat of our pants from now on, rejecting all previous norms, alliances, and treaties, what does that imply for how we might treat Israel tomorrow? What if Israel doesn't stay on the same side of issues with the Arab oil nations, who are mostly aligned with it at the moment? What if Iran collapses and there is no longer the same need for Israel's prominent military presence in the region? How will this administration react? And of course, in an even larger sense, what does this mean for the United States functioning on the international stage? Can our allies actually trust us? Should they? It's only the second week of January, and we're not quite through the first year of this administration. One wonders where we're headed. The last time around, in the first four Trump years, we had doubts about the sincerity of the president's pronouncements about Greenland and his threats to the bad people helming other nations. But now, he seems to mean them and be ready to do things about them. And his own people certainly don't restrain his impulsive actions at all. We should continue to hope Israel remains a positive priority here in America and that the apparently chaotic approach to foreign policy yields positive results and ultimately peaceful ones. Perhaps, in addition to hopes, you might want to offer a few prayers. To play us in this morning on a more optimistic note, here's a past guest of Too Jewish, the singer Matisyahu, and his wonderful anthem One Day about losing hope and finding it again.
Sometimes I lay under the moon. I thank God I'm breathing. And I pray, don't take me soon, 'cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday.
That was Matis Yahu singing his anthemic call for peace, One Day. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest this morning will be Samantha Ellis, author of the new memoir about her experience as an Iraqi Jew called Always Carry Salt. Meet her and learn about this fascinating Jewish community and her own experiences when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
Introducing Taste of Judaism, offering everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but never got to ask. Who was Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? Where does the concept of Brit Covenant come from? In three upbeat, fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, Taste of Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about, and have a great sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are offered at La Cholla and Tangerine in Oro Valley, and all classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, Taste of Judaism is offered free of charge, but you must pre-register. No cost to you, and the learning is invaluable. Free, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5676 or emailing execbeitsimcha@gmail.com or going to www.beitsimcha.tucson.org and signing up. Hundreds of thousands of students worldwide have taken Taste of Judaism. Why not join them? No obligation, just an energetic and great instructor, free food, fun, and a wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Call 520-276-5675 to register for Taste of Judaism, the most popular and effective introduction to Jewish learning and life. Call 520-276-5675 for your very own Taste of Judaism.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Samantha Ellis is the author of Always Carry Salt, a new book, a memoir of preserving language and culture. Really a great story, just a very interesting exploration of an aspect of history, of Jewish history and identity that are, I think, that's often omitted, forgotten. Welcome to Two Jewish. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
So, salt. Tell us about the title. I just love it.
Oh, thank you. I'm Iraqi Jewish. The whole book is about our community. And one thing we always did, and actually still do, is carry salt to ward off the evil eye. So we always believed that, you know, the evil eye was sort of around and it could kind of enter anyone. It wasn't their fault if it did, but you did want to ward it off. So my mum used to even sew it into the hems of my dresses when I was a little girl, just to keep it safe.
You know, it's funny. I, like a lot of mostly Ashkenazi Jews, I didn't know very much about the Iraqi Jewish community, except I knew it was incredibly ancient. And we started, then in rabbinical school, we were reading like Iraqi Jewish authors, and it was, wow, there's an incredible culture here. Tell us a little bit about how you came to want to explore this and to identify this aspect of your history in such a vivid way.
Thank you. Yes. It was when I became a mother, really. I'd always known that, you know, the language in particular was going extinct. I knew that there were very few speakers and we weren't passing it on. And in fact, I don't speak it. It's really my parents' generation, the last generation to speak it. But when I had a son and I realized I couldn't pass it on to him, I just felt this great sort of weight on me. And I wanted to know more about it before it was gone. And of course, you can't just do language. You've got to do everything that language contains, you know, the stories, the recipes, the swear words, you know, the idioms, everything, you know, the lore, it's about the rituals. It just felt like I needed to pin something down because it was slipping away.
You know, this Judeo-Arabic that you talk about, the Iraqi Judeo-Arabic, because there were various forms of Judeo-Arabic, but, you know, the Babylonian community where the Talmud was written, maybe the most important diaspora community for 2,000 years, has disappeared in the wake of war, immigration to Israel, immigration elsewhere. But you grew up with this language, right?
Yes, very much so. My father left Baghdad in 1951, which is when most of the Jews left Iraq, in an airlift, as you say, to Israel. My mother's family stayed till 1971, so I was born a few years later in London, but it was very recent for me.
It's an incredibly rich language, and in so many ways it influenced the development of Jewish life. Even after 50 to 51, there was an active Jewish community that preserved the language, but within the wake of the Gulf Wars, and I think really it's gone completely now.
I believe there's only one Jew, or possibly three Jews, left in the whole of Iraq, it depends who you ask.
It's kind of stunning. That immigration, which saved the lives and the families and the heritage to a degree, also has been kind of the reason this language has disappeared, right?
Yes. I mean, I think we were all scattered and there wasn't, you know, a body of us anywhere speaking it. In Israel, Iraqi Jews were encouraged to speak Hebrew. So like Yiddish speakers, that decision, you know, impacted on them. And they often felt ashamed to speak Arabic, even the Jewish Arabic, in the streets in Israel. It was, you know, there's a lot of stories of people feeling embarrassed and it was the language of the enemy, that kind of thing. And then in the wider world, I think there was a sense it was going extinct. We were never going back to Iraq. So what was the point?
Well, we'll find out more about what was the point when we come back in a moment with Samantha Ellis here on Too Jewish. The book is called Always Carry Salt. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established 7 years ago by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for services for Shabbat. Friday night is at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m., all led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. You can find out our service schedule. Go to the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. All of our services are live. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary and broadcast on our Facebook page. Call 520-276-5675 for more information about Beit Simcha. Religious school is available for school-age kids and grandchildren. Starting our new semester soon, join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come Friday night, 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, or attend on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson on Facebook. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those through the website as well. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses taught live and on Zoom, all of our wonderful life cycle ceremonies and services, and all of our services, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Greenland has been all over the news lately for strange reasons, but I wanted to note that to me, Greenland might be the least Jewish place I can think of on the planet. You've been everywhere. What is the least Jewish place you've ever been?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't usually look for absence of Jews. I look for the presence of Jews. So I can't certify that any place on earth is totally Judenrein. But first of all, the Maldives, which are a Muslim country and very remote from anything and not on any trading route.
Yeah, it's a flight from Sri Lanka. It's not close to anywhere, right?
Well, Sri Lanka is close to India.
Right, Sri Lanka is, but the Maldives, in order to get to the Maldives, I think you typically fly from Sri Lanka. I mean, it's really remote.
Or Dubai or Doha or any
right.
place. Yeah, the number of tourists in the Maldives at any given moment vastly exceeds the local population that is stable. So I couldn't rule out the possibility that there might not be some Jewish personnel in some of the many resorts out there. There's any stable, permanent Jewish community of Jewish residents in the Maldives. And that's a place that people might actually go. A place that people are unlikely to go, that I think also is pretty much free of Jews, is Burkina Faso in West Africa. You know that I was posted in the Ivory Coast for a while.
The Côte d'Ivoire, I do know that, yeah.
The Ivory Coast actually had not only a Jewish community, but a very large Israeli community of civil engineers and bridge builders. This was part of like Israel's once existing and very successful attempt to aid developing countries in sub-Saharan Africa. So, but there were also local Jews, Jews who came from like British Sudan when it stopped being Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, and from all the other places in Africa. It's a big city. I mean, there were like probably 250,000 Lebanese there. So Jews could at least eat well because Lebanese food is pretty close to Israeli food. But Burkina Faso, which is a landlocked country to the north and a very poor country, I don't think ever had any trade routes. It didn't have like the salt caravan that went to and from Timbuktu and Mali, and it didn't have much of anything. So I, to the best of my knowledge, there are no Jews residing in Burkina Faso. Now, half your listeners could tell me that I'm wrong, and they might be, you know, they might be right. But my guess is that's a pretty un-Jewish place. The thing about Greenland is there are no real cities there. Now, there are little settlements, but there's not the sort of urban infrastructure that it takes to sustain a Jewish community in terms of synagogues or anything. So, yeah, I mean, I think you might be right that Greenland is the least Jewish place you can think of.
The other place I was thinking of is I remember you posting or texting or something once when you were in Mongolia, maybe sitting next to a yurt, not drinking yak tea and yak buttered tea. And I thought that's a very un-Jewish place. And yet it had Jewish communities, historically speaking.
Because it had Russian communities and percentage of its population that was Jewish. So any place that there was Russian settlement in any significant numbers, there would be Jewish settlement as well.
Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
Introducing Taste of Judaism, offering everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but never got to ask. Who was Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? Where does the concept of Brit Covenant come from? In three upbeat, fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, Taste of Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about, and have a great sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are offered at La Cholla and Tangerine in Oro Valley, and all classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, Taste of Judaism is offered free of charge, but you must pre-register. No cost to you, and the learning is invaluable. Free, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5676 or emailing execbeitsimcha@gmail.com or going to www.beitsimcha.tucson.org and signing up. Hundreds of thousands of students worldwide have taken Taste of Judaism. Why not join them? No obligation, just an energetic and great instructor, free food, fun, and a wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Call 520-276-5675 to register for Taste of Judaism, the most popular and effective introduction to Jewish learning and life. Call 520-276-5675 for your very own Taste of Judaism.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A deeply pious and profoundly observant Orthodox rabbi passes away. He's greeted in heaven joyously by the angel Gabriel. Welcome, Rabbi. You're expected. We're thrilled to have you join us here in heaven in the Olam Haba in Gan Eden. Thank you, says the rabbi. The angel Gabriel continues, in fact, you're such a valued arrival in heaven, so pious, we've prepared a special banquet just in your honor. I see, says the rabbi. Our angelic chefs have cooked all the finest delicacies for your enjoyment, adds the angel Gabriel. I see, says the rabbi. It's all kosher? Of course, says the angel. This is heaven. I see, says the rabbi. Please tell me, who is the mashgiach? Who is the rabbi supervising the kashrut? The mashgiach, answers the angel Gabriel. Why? It's the Kodesh Baruch Hu. God himself is supervising that it's kosher. I see, says the rabbi. In that case, I'll have the fruit plate. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. You see, even God is not kosher enough for this Orthodox rabbi. Never mind. And now a word of Torah. This week we continue the narrative of the truly greatest story ever told, the tale of God and Moses liberating our people from slavery, bringing them to freedom. Our portion of Vayera continues the dramatic showdown between Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and God. Vayera is filled with the supernatural. God brings plagues on Egypt that cause untold suffering, not just to lordly Pharaoh, but to the ordinary folks living everyday lives. The stakes rise continually, and in a narrative that builds in power, plagues strike one after the other after the other. Pharaoh several times agrees to free the Israelites, only to repeatedly welch on the deal. At the end of Vayera, we sense that it's all building to a climax, which we will see in next week's even more dramatic tale in Bo of the actual exodus from slavery to freedom. You know, in our time, we see the might and terror of natural disasters, the destruction, awesome as it is, of volcanic eruptions and tsunamis, wildfires burning up major parts of our cities. We understand our own powerlessness in the face of such destruction. Without comparing the divine role in each of these, we can still understand the message of this Torah portion of Vayera. We are not the ones truly in control. That power and command, they belong only to God. When Pharaoh rails against that simple fact, he is foretelling our own contemporary need to pretend that we're the ones in charge. It's simply not so. When we, like Moses, acknowledge God's power and control over nature, when we come to understand that it's really all in God's hands, we, like Moses again, can focus on the things that we do have the power to accomplish. Caring for the sick, helping the needy, consoling the bereaved, caring for our environment, seeking justice in our own nation and the world. May we do so with sincerity and passion. We'll return in a moment on To Jewish. Our guest, Samantha Ellis, explains how her identity as an Iraqi Jew shaped her response to life in England and in extraordinarily different situations. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohai.
A property belonging to the Anti-Semitism Commissioner for the German state of Brandenburg was targeted in an arson attack last week. Andreas Buttner, the state's commissioner for combating anti-Semitism, wrote that his family was home at the time of the attack, which targeted a shed on his property in Templin, a small town in Brandenburg. He said no one was injured. "This attack represents a massive escalation," wrote Buttner. "It is directed against me personally, against my family, against my home. At the same time, it's an expression of hatred and intimidation. I will not be intimidated by this." An inverted red triangle, a symbol Hamas uses to mark its targets in propaganda videos, was also spray-painted on the front door of a house adjacent to the shed. Following the attack, Buttner told the Jüdische Allgemeine, Germany's weekly Jewish newspaper, that while he wouldn't speculate about the perpetrators, he believes the symbol speaks volumes. The red Hamas triangle is an internationally recognized symbol of jihadist violence and anti-Semitic incitement, said Buttner. Anyone who uses something like that wants to intimidate and glorify terror. This isn't a protest, it's a threat. The suspected arson, which is being investigated by police, marked the second recent attack against Buttner, whose car was defaced with swastikas in August of 2024. Buttner, who is not Jewish, serves as one of 15 state anti-Semitism czars in Germany, which also has a federal anti-Semitism commissioner, Felix Klein. The country's only Jewish anti-Semitism commissioner, Stefan Hensel of Hamburg, stepped down from his role in December amid rising threats. The attack on Andreas Buttner's house is a cowardly and deeply alarming expression of anti-Semitism, which we as a state and society must resolutely oppose with all available means, Klein said. Whether it hides behind swastikas, Hamas triangles, or other dehumanizing symbols, anti-Semitism remains anti-Semitism. The suspected arson comes amid a sharp rise in anti-Semitic incidents in Germany over the course of the war in Gaza. In April, the country ordered the deportation of three European nationals and one U.S. citizen over their activity at pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Ram Prosor, the ambassador of Israel to Germany, wrote that he believed Buttner will only stand up even more resolutely against anti-Semitism following this attack. "For the radical part of the Palestine Solidarity Movement is not only anti-Semitic, but terrorist," wrote Prosor. "Attacks on those who think differently and attempt murder, that is what the Hamas Triangle stands for, in Gaza as in Brandenburg. And the hatred of Israel goes hand in hand with hatred of our democracy." In other news, two British Jewish groups are calling for the ouster of a local police chief over claims that the force allegedly mishandled the banning of Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from a soccer game back in November. The decision to ban the fans from a match against Aston Villa Football Club on November 6 was initially made after the West Midlands Police advised the group responsible for issuing safety certificates for the game to ban the fans over quote-unquote public safety concerns. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and a host of Jewish groups decried the decision at the time. Now a parliamentary British tribunal has increased scrutiny on the police department's decision-making. While the police claimed that hundreds of Maccabi fans had targeted Muslim communities the night before a 2024 game in Amsterdam, Amsterdam police disputed their characterization of that confrontation. That violence, they said, was driven by people targeting the Maccabi fans, not being targeted by them. At the tribunal, Chair Dame Karen Bradley accused the local police force of scraping to find a reason to justify the ban. West Midland Police's Chief Constable Craig Guildford defended the decision, saying, "I'm really sorry if it comes across that way. That was absolutely not the case." And in happier sports news, Alon Leichman was headed home to Israel to celebrate his wedding with his family when he made a group chat with the new coaching staff for the Colorado Rockies to begin planning for his role as the team's head pitching coach, a first for any Israeli. Leichman, who grew up on Kibbutz Gezer and was first introduced to baseball on a field his father built, wrapped up a season as assistant pitching coach for the Miami Marlins last season and then received the news he was being promoted to head pitching coach for the woebegone Rockies. "Thank you, Miami. You've changed my life. Can't wait for what's next with the Rockies and Colorado," wrote Leichman. Before joining the Marlins, Leichman served as the assistant pitching coach for the Reds for 2 years. Earlier in his career, he played and coached for Team Israel, including a stint as bullpen coach at the 2017 World Baseball Classic. In March, Leichman will be the head pitching coach for Team Israel at the 2026 World Baseball Classic. That's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Samantha Ellis is the author of the new book, Always Carry Salt, about not just about language, really, it's about culture, but about Iraqi Judeo-Arabic. Part of the problem is there's not a name for that language. It's not Ladino or Yiddish or something. What should it be called, do you think?
Judeo-Iraqi-Arabic, what UNESCO calls it, but people call it Judeo-Baghdadi, or which I don't really love because I spoke it in other parts of Iraq too. Or they call it all sorts of things. I mean, growing up, we called it things like Haki Malna in Arabic, which means our talk, you know, or Arabi Malna, our Arabic. It just doesn't have a fixed name. It was always mainly an oral language, which makes it even harder to sort of pin it down really now.
What is it about the language that touches something in you personally?
I mean, for a start, it was the language I was spoken to as a child, and I think that probably will always be something so intimate for you. You know, I was soothed in it as a child. It was what all the adults were speaking around me. It was where all the stories were. You know, I really wanted to know what the stories were, and I remember because my parents didn't speak it to me. They spoke it to each other. So I remember sitting under the table at my grandmother's house in the suburbs in London and listening to them all talk above the table. And I just wanted to know what they were saying. You know, the gossip was in it, the stories, everything exciting was happening in that language, not in English.
How was it trying to teach your own children this language?
Oh, my son, well, he is not speaking it. I mean, to be fair, he wouldn't have no one really to speak it to apart from
you,
my family,
right,
my parents, really. I just feel it's not, I don't speak it, he's not going to speak it, but he does know some phrases. He knows a lot of the words and food he likes. His accent is better than mine. So, you know, let's see what happens. He's only eight.
There are some phrases that are really unique. There's one that you said you used as a party trick as a kid. Can you share it with us?
I will. Forgive me, my accent is terrible, but
I promise we will not know the difference.
I bet you some of your listeners will call in.
Maybe.
Let me try. It's Dindatil Kels, Halua Bilkasa, And it means you can put the curly tail of a dog inside a sugarcane tube and leave it in there for 40 days and 40 nights, and when you take it out, it will still be curly. So it's the leopard never changed its spots. It's just really long.
It's really long. And it makes the same kind of sense that most of those little proverbial statements make, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
There's an aspect, I think, to Iraq's culture that, you know, we in the West don't understand the depth, the ancients of it, the Epic of Gilgamesh, that you mentioned some of these things in your book. Look, in moving anywhere and relocating and leaving your culture, you're going to lose something. Tell us a little bit about trying to preserve some of that.
Yes, I mean, I had this sense really that there was a sort of flood coming and I needed to build an ark and put everything on it that I could preserve, you know, these the story of the flood is an Iraqi story, so we take it sort of personally, but I had this sense, you know, I had to pile everything on. I felt the language was going, obviously. The food we were clinging to and still are, the great cookery writer Claudia Rogen, she says often the food is the last thing to go when you lose culture. And that was something I felt kind of more sure of. But there were lots of other things that were going. I mean, stories, I felt. I'd heard these stories even of what had happened to my family, but you know how you hear them piecemeal and, you know, maybe you're interrupted or you hear them as a child and they don't tell you the really bad bits. There was something that I really needed to sit down with my family, and it was so helpful to me psychologically, let alone whether it might be useful to anyone else. So it's helpful to me to get the stories down and to say, but when did this happen? Did this happen before that other story that you've always told me, or afterwards? And how did this happen? And why did that happen? And what did you feel about it? And just to really get into all those questions and to learn more about it. And just things like the music as well. I mean, just to spend time listening to the music. There was a huge musical tradition. At one point, most of the musicians in Iraq in the 20s and 30s were Jewish. And, you know, this has often been erased from history. Certainly in Iraq, it was erased, the story of the Jewish musicians. And it was just wonderful to reconnect with all of that and really learn about it, as well as having heard the music since I was a child, but to just to learn about the story behind it.
Tell us about your name a little bit. Ellis doesn't sound all that Iraqi or Jewish.
No, it's not. My father's surname was Elias, and he changed it because there was a feeling that it would be easier to have an English name, certainly to have a business and to have an English name in England in the 60s. So that's why he changed it. My mother's maiden name is Hakim, which means doctor, which is much more Iraqi. But I considered going back to one of those names, but I don't know, I think I'm too old to change my name now.
You know, the relationship to Iraq was complicated. There were terrible anti-Semitic times in Iraq and in Baghdad. There were massacres and such. Never experienced the Holocaust, fortunately, because the Nazis didn't get that far. But did your parents and did your family have mixed feelings about the Iraqi heritage?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I'd say some of my family really hankered for Iraq, and others said, you know, it was terrible there. We suffered there. We're lucky that we're here now. And it really did depend on everyone's personalities and also what they've been through. My grandmother, for example, she lived through the Farhud, which was a sort of pogrom that happened in 1941.
Right, the Farhud.
Inspired by and supported by the Nazis. But if you talk to her about it, she would always emphasize the people who helped her, mainly Muslim families who helped her, the neighbors who helped the family and ensured that they survived, and also even ensured their house wasn't looted. You know, that was the depth of people's affection for their Jewish neighbors in many cases. So there are those stories as well to set against what happened.
You have an interesting, not even a story, just an anecdote about your grandfather remembering seeing Gertrude Bell, the famous spy, diplomat, whatever she was, representative of English imperialism, but then in indigenism, riding on the banks of the Tigris in white. It's a great story.
Absolutely, yeah. They all called her the lady.
Have you ever been able to go back to Iraq?
No. It's been a criminal offense to have any association with the State of Israel for a long time in Iraq. I think since the Jews left, pretty much. I'm not sure. But it's a law really designed to exclude Iraqi Jews because so much of the community was airlifted to Israel from Iraq that everyone has an association with Israel. And certainly in my case, my dad. And a couple of years ago, they sort of doubled down and made that a death penalty offence. So, I mean, there are some Jews who've gone to Iraq, but I don't feel safe.
The essence of the book in describing this story, and there were, in the period after the Farhud, the late 40s, the early 50s, development of the State of Israel, 125,000 Iraqi Jews left Iraq for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You guys didn't end up in Israel. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, my father's family did go to Israel, and he was in the Ma'av Arad, the transit camp, and then he, most of his family, his side of the family is still there.
Hopefully not in Ma'av Arad still, but still in Israel.
No, in Tel Aviv.
Those were not such pleasant places, I think.
No. And he came to London and during the 60s to study and then ended up staying where he met my mother. My mother's family came directly here because they had more relatives here and they were coming in 1971 and it was just a very different time. There was no airlift. They came separately. My parents fell in love in London. They met at the Iraqi Jewish Social Club and that's where they met.
Right. The experience that you relate really, I think a lot of people just don't know the story of any of the Edot HaMizrach Jews, the Jews of the Eastern communities, Iraq, Yemen, Iran for that matter, Syria, all of these very significant, super ancient Jewish communities who were essentially decimated during World War II, after World War II. I just remember reading a Sammy Michael story about coming to Israel and feeling alien and the breakdown in the generations. A famous Iraqi Jewish writer in Israel. Did you guys have some of those generational divides in your family?
I mean, I remember my father telling me that when they got to Israel, his own father couldn't really get much work, and that was very difficult. And it was very difficult for his parents to switch into Hebrew. Much easier for him at 11 to, learn a new language and get on with things. So there was that, certainly. I think the divides are more, not really divides, but the debates, I'd say, are more about how everyone feels about our Iraqi heritage now. And some people, really miss the place and the culture, and other people really have settled where we are. And so that's a sort of, and of course we also always argue about the food.
This is kind of a bit outside the realm of the book, but the book is a really valuable book for anybody, for everybody who doesn't know the depth of the Mizrahi experience, both coming out of this incredible Jewish culture in Iraq and then the experience in Israel and so on. But I was thinking, Mizrahi Jews are, between Mizrahi and Sephardi Jews, are the majority in Israel now. Is there a certain revenge going on, would you say, in turning the tide on the Ashkenazi, Ashkenormative aspect of Israeli society?
I mean, I think there was certainly a situation where Mizrahi Jews in Israel were not able to express our culture, certainly not able to speak the language freely. And, I mean, yes, there is a certain delight to the fact that all restaurants serve Mizrahi food now.
They're all, everything. It's funny, we went to the new Knesset Museum and, you could see in 1949 or 50 or whatever it was, they had, gefilte fish and borscht on the menu. You'd be hard-pressed to find that anywhere in Israel today.
Well, I think so. I mean, obviously, it's a shame for one culture to dominate. I mean, it would be lovely to be able to have everything.
I think you kind of do. If you wanted your family to take one message out of Always Carry Salt, what would it be?
My family?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think, well, because the book has been out in the UK for a little while, so one thing that's been amazing is I definitely feel we're all more connected, and some of my younger relatives, you know, have been reading it and talking to their own parents about their stories, because I really kept the story very tight and just spoke to my parents and my grandmother. There are so many other stories I could have included, but it's been amazing hearing stories about my uncles and my aunts and, you know, cousins, and just all this other stuff has come up that I didn't know about. So I think just it does help you, or it has only helped me, to know more about where I come from. I think it helps me know more about where I'm going.
I want to thank Samantha Ellis for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Always Carry Salt. I think it's just a really valuable book for anyone, but particularly those who don't know enough about the Iraqi Jewish community and really all of the Edot HaMizrach. Thank you so much. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book?
I have a website, which is www.samanthaellis.me.uk.
Thank you so much, Samantha.
Thanks so much.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways, and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Introducing Taste of Judaism, offering everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but never got to ask. Who was Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? Where does the concept of Brit Covenant come from? In three upbeat, fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, Taste of Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about, and have a great sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are offered at La Cholla and Tangerine in Oro Valley, and all classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, Taste of Judaism is offered free of charge, but you must pre-register. No cost to you, and the learning is invaluable. Free, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5676 or emailing execbeitsimcha@gmail.com or going to www.beitsimchatucson.org and signing up. Hundreds of thousands of students worldwide have taken Taste of Judaism. Why not join them? No obligation, just an energetic and great instructor, free food, fun, and a wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Call 520-276-5675 to register for Taste of Judaism, the most popular and effective introduction to Jewish learning and life. Call 520-276-5675 for your very own Taste of Judaism.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, each Friday night for services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona.